Up. Hang on, I just remembered. I have something for you if you're interested. I reached into the outer zippered compartment of my shoulder bag and pulled out one of the black and white photographs of Tom at the April banquet. I had these done up in case I needed 'em. You might like to have something to remember him by. She took the picture without comment, a slight smile playing across her mouth as she studied it. I said, I never met him myself, but I thought it captured him. She looked up at me with tears rimming her eyes.
Thank you.
Chapter 16. When I returned from my run the next morning, there was a message from Colleen Sellers on my answering machine, giving me the name and Perdido address of a woman named Dolores Ruggles, one of Pinky Ritter's daughters. As this represented the only lead I had, I gassed up the VW and headed south on 101 as soon as I was showered and dressed. On my left I could see fields under cultivation, the newly planted rows secured by layers of plastic sheeting as slick and gray as ice. Steep hills, rough with low-growing vegetation, began to crowd up against the highway. On my right, the bleak Pacific Ocean thundered against the shore. Surfers in black wetsuits waited on rocking boards like a scattered flock of seabirds. The rains had moved on, but the sky was still white, with a ceiling of sluggish clouds, and the air was thick with the mingled scents of brine and recent precipitation. Snow would be falling in the high Sierras near Noda Lake. I took the leeward off-ramp and made two left turns, crossing over the freeway again in search of the street where Dolores Ruggles lived. The neighborhood was a warren of low stucco structures, narrow streets intersecting one another repeatedly. The house was a plain box, sitting in a plain treeless yard with scarcely a bush or a tuft of grass to break up the monotonous flat look of the place. The porch consisted of a slab of concrete, with one step leading up to the front door, and a small cap of roofing to protect you as you rang the bell, which I did. The door was veneer with long, sharp splinters of wood missing from the bottom edge. It looked like a dog had been chewing on the threshold. The man who opened the door was drying his hands on a towel tucked into the waist of his trousers. He was easily in his 60s, maybe 5'8", with a coarsely lined face and a thinning head of gray-white hair, the color of wood ash. His eyes were hazel, his brows a tangle of wiry black and gray.
"Keep your shirt on," he said irritably.
"Sorry, I thought the bell was broken. I wasn't even sure anyone was home. I'm looking for Dolores Ruggles."
"Who the hell are you?"
I handed him my card, watching his lips move while he read my name. "I'm a private investigator," I said.
"I can see that. It says right here. Now we got that established, what do you want with Dolores? She's busy at the moment and doesn't want to be disturbed."
"I need some information. Maybe you can help me and we can spare her the imposition. I'm here about her father."
"The little shithead was murdered."
"I'm aware of that."
"Then what's it to you?"
"I'm trying to find out what happened."
"What difference does it make? The man is D-E-A-D dead and not soon enough to suit my taste. I've spent years coping with all the damage he did."
"Could I come in?" He stared at me.
"Help yourself,"
he said abruptly, and turned on his heel, leaving me to follow. I scurried after him, taking a quick mental photograph as we passed through the living room. Not to sound sexist, but the room looked as if it had been designed by a man. The floors were bare hardwood, stained dark. I noted a tired couch and a sagging upholstered chair, both shrouded by heavy woven Indian print rugs. I thought the coffee table was antiqued, but I could see as I passed the only patina was dust. The walls were lined with books, upright, sideways, slanting, stacked, packed too deep on some shelves, three deep on others. The accumulation of magazines, newspapers, junk mail, and catalogs suggested a suffocating indifference to tidiness.
"I'm doing dishes out here," he said as he moved into the kitchen. "Grab a towel and you can pitch in. You might as well be useful as long as you're picking my brain. By the way, I'm Homer, Dolores' husband. Mr. Ruggles to you."
His tone had shifted from outright rudeness to something gruff, but not unpleasant. I could see he'd been rather good-looking in his day. Not wildly handsome, but something better, a man with a certain amount of character and an appealing air. His skin was darkly tanned and heavily speckled with sun damage, as if he'd spent all his life toiling in the fields. His shirt was an earth brown with an elaborately embroidered yoke done in threads of gold and black. He wore cowboy boots that I suspected were intended to add a couple of inches to his height. By the time I reached the kitchen, he turned on the water again, and he was already back at work, washing plates and glassware.
"Towels in there,"
he said, nodding at the drawer to his immediate left. I took out a clean dish towel and reached for a plate, still hot from the rinse water.
"You can stack those on the kitchen table. I'll put 'em up when we're done."
I glanced at the table. Mr. Ruggles, the table needs to be wiped. Do you have a sponge?" Homer turned and gave me a look.
"This is a telling trait of yours, isn't it?"
"Oh, sure," I said.
"Skip the Mr. Ruggles bit. It sounds absurd."
"Yes, sir." That netted me half a smile. He wrung out the cloth and tossed it in my direction with a shake of his head. I wiped off the tabletop, setting several items aside. Newspaper, salt and pepper shakers, shaped like the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood, a clutch of pill bottles with Dolores's name plastered on them, along with various warning labels. Whatever she was taking, she was supposed to avoid alcohol, excessive exposure to sunlight, and the operation of heavy machinery. I wondered if this referred to cars, tractors, or Amtrak locomotives. When I'd finished, I handed him the rag and then picked up the dish towel and resumed wiping the plate.
"So, what's the deal?" he said belatedly. "What's your interest in Pinky Ritter? Nice girl like you should be ashamed."
"I didn't know anything about him until yesterday. I've been tracking down a friend of his who may have been..." "Could we just skip this part? It's almost too tricky to explain."
"You're talking Alfie Toth."
"Thank you. That's right. Everybody seems to know about him."
"Yeah, well, Alfie was a bird brain. Women thought he was attractive, but I couldn't see it myself. How can you think some guy's handsome when you know he's dim? To my way of thinking, it spoils the whole effect. I think he hung out with my father-in-law for protection, which just goes to show you how dumb he was."
"You knew Alfie was dead?"
"You bet. The police told us about it when his body turned up. They came around asking the same question you probably want answered, which is, what's the connection and who did what to whom? I'll give you the same answer I gave them. I don't know."
"What's the story on Pinky? I take it you didn't think much of him."
"That's a gross understatement. I really hated his guts. Whoever killed Pinky saved me life in prison. Pinky had 6 kids, 3 sons and 3 daughters, and mistreated every one of them from the day they were born till they got big enough to fight back. Nowadays there's all this talk of abuse, but Pinky did the real thing. He punched them, burned them, made them drink vinegar and hot sauce for talking back to him. He locked them in closets, set them out in the cold. He screwed them, starved them, threatened them. He hit them with belts, boards, metal pipes, sticks, hair brushes, fists. Pinky was the meanest son of a bitch I ever met, and that's going some."
"Didn't anybody intervene?"
"People tried. A lot of people blew the whistle on him. Trick was trying to prove it. Teachers, guidance counselors, next-door neighbors. Sometimes children's services managed to take the kids away from him and foster them out. Judge always gave him back."
He shook his head. "Pinky knew how the game was played. He kept a clean house. The kids saw to that.
And he did like to cook. That was his specialty. It's what he did for a living when he wasn't breaking their heads or breaking the law. Social workers came around and everything looked fine. Kids knew better than to open their mouths. Dolores says she can remember the 6 of them lined up in the living room, answering questions just as nice as you please. Pinky wouldn't be in the room, but he was always somewhere close. Kids knew better than to rat on him or they'd be dead by dark. They'd stand there and lie. Said social workers knew, but couldn't get anything on him without their assistance. Only thing saved him was his getting thrown in jail."
"What about his wife? Where was she all this time?"
"Dolores thinks he killed her, though it couldn't be proved. He claims she ran off with some barfly and was never heard from again. Dolores says she remembers as a kid waking up in the dead of night. Pinky was out in the woods behind the house with a power saw. Lantern on the ground throwing these big shadows up against the trees. Moths fluttering around the light. She still has nightmares about that. She was the baby in the family, 6 years old at the time. I think the oldest was 15. She went out there next day. The ground was all turned, probably to hide the blood. She still remembers the smell, like a package of chicken when it's gone funny and has to be thrown out. Mom was never seen nor heard from again. Pinky sounds like a very nasty piece of work. The worst. So anybody could have killed him, including one of his kids. Is that what you're saying? That would cover it, he said. Of course, by the time he died, they were out from under his control. The rest of the kids had scattered to hell and gone. Couple of them still in California, though we don't see 'em all that much. Homer finished the last dish and turned the water off. I continued drying silverware while he put away the clean plates. When did you see him last? 5 years ago in March. The minute he got out of Chino, he headed straight up here, arrived on the 25th, and stayed a week. Good memory, I remarked. The cops asked me about that, so I looked it up. How I pinpointed the date is I withdrew $500 from a bank account the day Pinky left. I counted backward from that, and the date stuck in my mind. Anything else you want to quiz me about? I didn't mean to interrupt. Go on. Dolores was the only kid of his still living in the area, so naturally he felt she owed him room and board for as long as he liked. She agreed to that? Of course. Didn't you object? I did, but that was an argument I couldn't win. She felt guilty. She's a hell of a gal, and what she's endured, believe me, you don't want to know. But the upshot is, she's anxious to please, easily manipulated, especially when it came to him. She wanted that man's love. Don't ask me to explain, given what she suffered. He was still daddy to her, and she couldn't turn him away. He was just like he always was, demanding, critical. He refused to lift a finger, expecting her to wait on him hand and foot. I finally got fed up and told him to clear out. Pinky says, "Fine, no problem. I won't stay where I'm not wanted. To hell with you," he says. He was sore as a boil and feeling much put upon, but I was damned if I'd back down. Toth was with him at the time? Off and on. I think Alfie's ex-wife lived in town somewhere. He mooched off her when he wasn't here mooching off us. And the two left together? As far as I know. At least, that was the plan. And where were they headed? Los Angeles. You piece it together later, and it turns out they stole a car in Los Angeles and drove up to Lake Tahoe. What about Pinky's parole officer? Wasn't he supposed to report in? Hey, you're talking a career criminal. Following the rules wasn't exactly his strong suit. Who the hell knows how he got away with it? Same with Toth.
You think someone could have been after them?
I wouldn't know, he said. Pinky didn't act like he was worried. Why? You think somebody might have been trailing them?
It's possible, I said.
Yeah, well, it's also possible Pinky overstepped his bounds for once. He was one of those little guys, chip on his shoulder and feisty as all get out. I can't say that about Alfie. He seemed harmless. Pinky's another matter. Whoever killed Pinky should get a medal, in my opinion, and don't quote me. Dolores gets upset if she hears me talking like that. I notice I'm doing all the talking.
I appreciate that.
This is good. I appreciate your appreciation. Now it's your turn. What's a private investigator doing in the middle of a homicide investigation? Last I heard, they didn't have a suspect, so you can't be working for the public defender's office.
Given his cooperation, I thought he was entitled to an explanation. I filled him in on the situation, beginning with Selma Newquist and ending with Colleen Sellers. The only thing I omitted were details of the two killings. He didn't seem curious about specifics, and I wouldn't have revealed the information for all the money in the world. In the meantime, on an almost subliminal level, I could hear an odd series of voices from another room. At first I thought the sound was coming from a radio or television set, but the phrases were repeated, the tone lifeless and mechanical. Homer heard it too, and his gaze caught mine. He tilted his head in the direction of the short hallway that seemed to lead into a back bedroom.
"Dolores is back there. You want to talk to her?"
"If you think it's okay."
"She can handle it," he said. "Give me a second and I'll tell her what's going on. She might have something to add."
He moved down the hall to the door, tapping once before he entered. As he eased through the opening, I felt a moment's unease. Here I was in a strange house in the company of a man I'd never laid eyes on before. I had taken him at face value, trusting him on instinct, though I wasn't sure why.
Really, I only had his word for it that Dolores was in the other room. I had one of those flash fantasies of him emerging from the bedroom with a butcher knife in hand. Fortunately, life, even for a private eye, is seldom this interesting. The door opened again, and Homer motioned me in. At first sight, I thought Dolores Ruggles couldn't have been a day over 25. Later I found out that she was 28, which still seemed too young to be married to a man Homer's age. Slim, petite, she sat at a workbench in a room filled with Barbie dolls. Floor to ceiling, wall to wall, dressed in an astonishing array of styles, these bland plastic women were decked out in miniature sundresses, evening clothes, suits, furs, shorts, capes, pedal pushers, bathing suits, baby doll pajamas, sheaths, each outfit complete with appropriate accessories. There was a whole row of Barbie brides, though I'd never thought of her as married. The row below showed 20 Barbies uniformed as flight attendants and nurses, which must have represented the entire gambit of career options available to her. Some of the dolls were still in their boxes, and some were freestanding, affixed to round plastic mounts. There was a row of seated Barbies, black, Hispanic, blonde, brunette, their long, perfect legs extended like a chorus line, all shoeless, their unblemished limbs ending in nearly pointed toes. Their arms were long and impossibly smooth. Their necks must have contained extra vertebrae to support the weight of their tousled manes of hair. I confess I found myself at a loss for words. Homer leaned against the open door, watching for my reaction. I could tell something was expected of me, so I said, "Amazing," in what I hoped was a properly respectful tone. Homer laughed. "I thought you'd like that. I don't know a woman alive who can resist a room full of dolls." I said, "Ah." Dolores glanced at me shyly. She had a doll in her lap, not a Barbie to all appearances, but some other type. With a little hammer and an X-Acto knife, she was cutting open its stomach. There was a box of identical little plastic girls, sexless, unmarred, standing close together with their chests pierced in a pattern of holes like those old-fashioned radio speakers. Beside them, there was a box of little girls' heads, eyes demurely closed, a smile turning up the corners of each set of perfect lips.
"Chatty Cathy's," she said. "It's a new hobby. I fix their voices so they can talk again."
"That's great," Homer said. "I'll leave you girls to your own devices. You have a lot you want to talk about." He closed me into the room with her, as pleased with himself as a parent introducing two new best friends to each other. Clearly, he hadn't guessed my unfortunate history with surrogate children. My first, a Betsy Wetsy, if she'd survived, would have had to enter therapy at some point in her life. At age 6, I thought it was a bore to be constantly feeding her those tiny bottles of water, and it annoyed me no end every time she peed in my lap. Once I figured out it was the water, I quit feeding her altogether, and then I used her as the pedestrian I ran over with my trike. This was my definition of motherly love, and probably explains why I'm not a parent today. "How many Barbies do you have?" I asked, feigning enthusiasm for the little proto-women.
"A little over 2,000. That's the star of my collection, a number one Barbie still in her original package. The seal's been broken, but she's in near mint condition. I'm afraid to tell you what I paid."
Her speech was uninflected, her manner without effect. She made little eye contact, addressing most of her comments to the doll as she worked. "Homer's always been very supportive." "I can see that," I said. "I'm a bit of a purist. A lot of collectors are interested in others in the line. You know, Francie, Tootie, and Todd, Jamie, Skipper, Christy, Kara, Casey, Buffy. I never cared for them myself, and certainly not Ken. Did you have a Barbie as a kid?" "I can't say I did," I said. I picked one up and examined her. "She looks like she's suffering from some sort of eating disorder, doesn't she? What prompted you to get into Chatty Cathy's? That seems far afield for a Barbie purist."
"Most of the chatties aren't mine. I'm repairing them for a friend who runs a business doing this.
It's not as far-fetched as it seems. Chatty Cathy was introduced in 1960, the year after Barbie. Chatty Cathy was more realistic. Freckles, buck teeth, little pot belly. This in addition to her ability to speak.
Even with Barbie, 1967 to 1973 is known as the talking era, which includes the twist and turn dolls. Few people realize that.
I know I didn't, I said. What's that thing?
That's the little 3-inch vinyl record of Kathy's sayings. When you pull the string, it activates a spring that makes that little rubber belt drive the turntable. The early versions of the doll had 11 sayings, but that was increased to 18. Odd thing about Chatties is that no two look alike. Of course, they were mass-produced, but they all seem to be different. It's almost creepy in some ways. Anyway, I'm sure you didn't drive all the way down here to talk about dolls. You're interested in my father.
Homer filled me in, but I'd like to hear your version. I understand he and Alfie Toth spent some time with you just after they were released from Chino.
That's right. Pops was feeling sorry for himself because none of the other kids wanted anything to do with him. He tried to spend a night with my brother Clint. He lives down in Inglewood by the L.A. airport. Clint's still bitter about Pops. He refused to let him in, but he told him he could sleep in the tool shed if he wanted to. Pops was furious, of course, so he left in a huff, but not before he broke into Clint's house. Him and Alfie waited till Clint was gone, stole his cash, and busted up all his furniture.
That must have been a big hit. Did Clint report it to the police?
Dolores seemed startled, the first real reaction I'd seen.
Why would he do that? I've heard there was a plainclothes detective trying to serve a warrant against Toth around the time of his death. I'm wondering if it dated back to that same incident.
Dolores shook her head. I'm sure not. Clint would never do a thing like that. He might not want Pops in his house, but he'd never snitch on him. It's odd, but when my sister Maine called, this was just about a year ago, to say they'd found his body, I started laughing so hard I peed my pants. Homer had to call the doctor when it turned out I couldn't quit. Doctor gave me a shot to calm me down. He said it was hysteria, but it was actually relief. We hadn't heard from him for 5 years by then, so I guess I was waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Why do you think he went from Clint's to Lake Tahoe?
My sister lives up there, or one of them at any rate. Not in Lake Tahoe exactly, but that vicinity.
Really?
I've been curious what prompted him to travel in that direction. I don't think Mame's husband was any happier to see him than Homer was.
How long was he with her?
A week or so. Mame told me later, him and Alfie went off to go fishing, and that's the last anyone ever saw Pops, as far as I know.
Do you think I could talk to her? I'm sure the police have covered this ground, but it would be helpful to me.
Oh, sure, she isn't hard to find. She works as a clerk in the sheriff's department up there.
Up there where?
Noda Lake. Her name is Margaret, but everybody in the family calls her Mame.
Chapter 17. When I got home, Henry was in the backyard, kneeling in the flower bed. I crossed the lawn, pausing to watch him at work. He was aware of my presence, but seemed content with the quiet. He wore a white T-shirt and farmer's pants with padded knees. His feet were bare, long, and bony, the high arches very white against the faded grass. The air was sweet and mild. Even with the noon sun directly overhead, the temperature was moderate. I could already see crocuses and hyacinths coming up in clusters beside the garage. I sat down on a wooden lawn chair while he turned the soil with a hand trowel. The earth was soft and damp, worms recoiling from the intrusion when his efforts disturbed them. His rose bushes were barren sticks, bristling with thorns, the occasional leaf bud suggesting that spring was on its way. The lawn, which had been dormant much of the winter, was beginning to waken with the encouragement of recent rains. I could see a haze of green where the new blades were beginning to push up through the brown.
"People tend to associate autumn with death. But spring always seems a lot closer to me," he remarked.
"Why's that?"
"There's no deep philosophical significance. Somehow, in my history, a lot of people I love have ended up dying this time of year. Maybe they yearn to look out the window and see new leaves on the trees. It's a time of hope, and that might be enough if you're on your way out. Allows you to let go, knowing the world is moving on as it always has."
I have to go back to Noda Lake, I said.
When?
Sometime next week. I'd like to hang out here long enough to get my hand back in working order.
Why go at all?
I have to talk to someone.
Can't you do that by phone?
It's too easy for people to tell lies on the phone. I like to see faces, I said.
I was silent, listening to the homely chucking of his trowel in the dirt. I pulled my legs up and wrapped my arms around my knees.
Remember in the old days when we talked about vibes?
I could see Henry smile.
You have bad vibes?
The worst.
I held up my right hand and tried flexing the fingers, which were still so swollen and stiff I could barely make a fist.
Don't go. You don't have anything to prove.
Of course I do, Henry. I'm a girl. We're always trying to prove something.
Like what?
That we're tough. That we're as good as the guys, which I'm happy to report is not that hard.
If it's true, why do you have to prove it?
Comes with a turf. Just because we believe it doesn't mean guys do.
Who cares about men? Don't be macho.
I can't help it. Anyway, this isn't about pride. This is about mental health. I can't afford to let some guy intimidate me like that. Trust me, somewhere up in Noda Lake, he's laughing his ass off, thinking he's run me out of town.
The code of the West. A girl's gotta do what a girl's gotta do.
It feels bad, the whole thing. I don't remember feeling this much dread. That son of a bitch hurt me. I hate giving him the opportunity to do it again.
At least your tetanus shot's up to date.
Yeah, and my butt still hurts. I got a knot on my hip the size of a hard-boiled egg.
So, what worries you?
What worries me is I got my fingers dislocated before I knew jack shit. Now that I'm getting closer, what's the guy going to do? You think he'll go down without trying to take me with him?
Phone's ringing,
he remarked. God, Henry, how can you hear that? You're 86 years old.
3 rings.
I was off the chair and halfway across the yard by then. I left my door open and caught the phone on the fly, just as the machine kicked in. I pressed stop, effectively cutting off the message.
Hello, hello, hello? Kinsey, is that you? I thought this was your machine.
Hi, Selma, you lucked out. I was out in the yard.
I'm sorry to have to bother you.
Not a problem. What's up?
Someone's been searching Tom's study. I know this sounds odd, but I'm sure someone came in here and moved the items on his desk. It's not like the room was trashed, but something's off. I can't see that anything's missing, and I don't know how I'd prove it even if there was.
How'd they get in?
She hesitated.
I was only gone for an hour, maybe slightly more. I hardly ever lock the door for short periods like that.
What makes you so sure someone was there?
I can't explain. I'd been sitting in Tom's den earlier, before I went out. I was feeling depressed, and it seemed like a comfort just to sit in his chair. You know how it is when you think about things. You're aware of your surroundings because your gaze tends to wander while your mind is elsewhere. I guess I was realizing how much work you'd done. Anyway, when I got home, I set my handbag on the kitchen table and went back to the car. I'd picked up some boxes to finish packing Tom's books. The minute I walked into his den, I could see the difference.
You haven't had any visitors?
Oh, please, you know how people have been treating me. I might as well hang out a sign. Town siren, straying husbands, apply here.
What about Brent? How do you know he wasn't in there looking for something on Tom's desk?
I asked him, but he was at Sherry's until a few minutes ago.
I had him check the perimeter, but there's no sign of forced entry.
Who'd bother to force entrance with all the doors unlocked? I said.
Can Brandt tell if anything's missing?
He's in the same boat I'm in. It's certainly nothing obvious, if it's anything at all. Whoever it was seemed to work with great care.
It was only coincidental that I'd been in there this morning, or I don't think I'd have noticed.
Do you think I should call the sheriff's office?
Yeah, you better do that, I said. Later, if it turns out something's been stolen, you can follow up.
That's what Brandt said.
There was a tiny pause while she changed tacks, her voice assuming a faintly injured tone.
I must say I've been upset about your lack of communication. I've been waiting to hear from you.
Sorry, but I haven't had the chance. I was going to call you in a bit, I said.
I noticed how defensive I sounded in response to her reproof.
Now that I have you on the line, could you tell me what's happening? I assume you're still working even if you haven't kept in touch.
Of course. I controlled my desire to bristle, and I filled her in on my activities the past day and a half, sidestepping the personal aspects of Tom's relationship with Colleen Sellers. Telling a partial truth is much harder than an outright lie. Here I was trying to protect her while she was chiding me for neglect. Talk about ungrateful. I was tempted to tell all, but I repressed the urge. I kept my tone of voice professional while my inner kid hollered, "Up yours!" Tom came down here in June as part of an investigation. Do you remember the occasion? He was probably gone overnight.
Yes, she said slowly. It was 2 days. What's the relevance?
There was a homicide down here Tom felt was connected to some skeletal remains found in Nota County last spring.
I know the case you're referring to. He didn't say much about it, but I know it bothered him. What about it?
Well, if we're talking about an active homicide investigation, I don't have the authority. I'm a private investigator, which is the equivalent of doing freelance research. I can't, even on your say-so, stick my nose into police business.
I don't see why not. Surely there's no law against asking questions.
I have asked questions, and I'm telling you what I found. Tom was stressed out about matters that had nothing to do with you.
Why didn't he tell me what it was, if that's true?
You were the one who said he played things close to his chest, especially when it came to work.
Well, yes, but if this is strictly professional, then why would someone go to all the trouble to search the house?
Maybe the department needed his notes or his files or a telephone number or a missing report. It could be anything, I said, rattling off the possibilities as quickly as they occurred to me.
Why didn't they call and ask?
How do I know? Maybe they were in a hurry and you weren't home, I said, exasperated. It all sounded lame, but she was backing me into corners, and it was annoying me to no end.
Kinsey, I am paying you to get to the bottom of this. If I'd known you weren't going to help, I could have used that $1,500 to get my teeth capped.
I'm doing what I can. What do you want from me? I said.
Well, you needn't take that attitude. A week ago you were cooperative. Now all I'm hearing are excuses.
I had to bite my tongue. I had to talk in very distinct, clipped syllables to keep from screaming at her. I took a deep breath. Look, I have one lead left. As soon as I get up there, I'll be happy to check it out. But if this is Sheriff's Department business, then it's out of my hands. There was one of those silences that sounded like it contained an exclamation point.
If you don't want to finish the job, why don't you come right out and say so?
I'm not saying that.
Then when are you coming back?
I'm not sure yet. Next week. Maybe Tuesday.
Next week? She said. What's wrong with today? If you got in your car now, you could be here in 6 hours.
What's the big hurry? This has been going on for weeks.
Well, for one thing, you still owe me $500 worth of work. For that kind of money, I would think you'd want to get here as soon as possible.
Selma, I'm not going to sit here and argue about this. I'll do what I can.
Wonderful. What time shall I expect you?
I have no idea.
Surely you can give me some idea when you might arrive. I have other obligations. I'll be gone all day tomorrow. I go to 10 o'clock services and then spend some time with my cousin down in Big Pine. I can't sit around waiting for you to show up any time it suits. Besides, if you're coming, I'll need to make arrangements.
I'll call when I get there, but I'm not going to stay at the Nota Lake Cabins. I hate that place, and I won't be put in that position. It's too remote, and it's dangerous.
Fine, she said promptly. You can stay here at the house with me.
I wouldn't dream of imposing. I'll find another motel so there won't be any inconvenience for either one of us.
It's no inconvenience. I could use the company. Brandt thinks it's high time he moved back to his place. He's already in the process of packing up. The guest room is always ready. I insist. I'll have supper waiting and no arguments about that, please.
We'll talk about it when I get there, I said, trying to conceal my irritation. I was rapidly reassessing my opinion of the woman, ready to cast my vote with her legions of detractors. This was a side of her I hadn't seen before, and I was churning with indignation. Of course, I noticed I'd already started revising my mental timetable, preparing to hit the road as soon as possible. Having consented, in effect, I now found myself wanting to get it over with. I shortened the fare-thee-wells, trying to get her off the phone while I could. The minute I replaced the receiver, I picked it up again and placed a call to Colleen Sellers. While the interminable ringing of her line went on, I could feel my impatience mount. Come on, come on, be there.
Hello?
Colleen, it's Kinsey here.
What can I do for you?
She didn't sound that thrilled to hear from me, but I was through pussyfooting around. I just spent 30 minutes with Pinky Ritter's daughter Dolores and her husband. Turns out Pinky has another daughter, in Noda Lake, which is why he and Alfie went up there in the first place. And this is someone I've met, a woman named Margaret who works for the sheriff's department as a clerk. I'm going to have to go back up there and talk to her again, but I can't go without knowing what I'm up against. Why call me? I can't help. Yes, you can. Kinsey, I don't know anything about this, and frankly, I'm annoyed you keep pressing the point. Well, frankly, I guess I'll just have to risk your irritation. What's the matter with you, Colleen? Does it ever occur to you that I might find this painful? I mean, I'm sorry as hell for Selma, but she's not the only one who suffered a loss. I was in love with him, too, and I don't appreciate your constantly picking at the wound. Oh, really? Well, it's interesting that you should say so, because you want to know what I think is going on? I think it pisses you off that you never had any power or any control in that relationship. Tom may have taken the moral high ground, acting from his lofty-sounding principles, but the fact is he left you with nothing, and this is your payback. That's not true. Try again, I said. What's to pay back? He never did anything to me. Tom was a tease. He was willing to flirt, but he was quick to draw lines you couldn't cross. He could afford to enjoy your attention because it didn't cost him a thing. He accepted the tribute without taking any risks, which meant he got to feel virtuous while you were left like a kid with your nose pressed to the glass. You could see what you wanted, but you weren't allowed to touch. And now you're thinking that's the best you'll ever have, which is really bullshit because you didn't have anything. All this talk about pain is an attempt to sanctify a big, fat, emotional zero. I knew I was only ragging on her because Selma had ragged on me, but it felt good nonetheless. Later I'd feel guilty for being such a bitch, but for now it seemed like the only way to get what I wanted. She was silent for a moment. I could hear the intake of cigarette smoke followed by the exhale of her breath. Maybe. Maybe, my ass, it's the truth, I said. Everybody sees him as noble, but I think he was supremely egotistical. How honorable was he when he never had the courage to tell his wife? Tell her what? That he was tempted to be unfaithful because of his attraction to you. He didn't act on his feelings, but it's no bloody wonder she ended up feeling insecure. And what did it net you? You're still hung up on him, and you may never get yourself off the hook. Look, you really don't know what you're talking about, so let's skip all the homegrown psychology. Tell me what you want and get it over with. You have to level with me. Why? Because my life may depend on it, I snapped. Come on, Colleen, you're a professional. You know better. You sit there doling out little tidbits of information, hanging on to the crumbs because it's all you have. This is serious damn shit. If Tom were in your position, do you think he'd withhold information in a situation like this? She inhaled again. Probably not. Grudgingly. Then let's get on with it. If you know what's going on, for God's sake, let's have it. She seemed to hesitate. Tom was facing a moral crisis. I was the easy part, but I wasn't all of it. What do you mean you were the easy part? I'm not sure how to explain. I think he could do the right thing with me, and it was a comfort to him. That situation made sense, while the other problem he was facing was more complicated. You're just guessing at this, or do you know for a fact? Well, Tom never came out and said so, but he did allude to the issue. Something about not knowing how to reconcile his head and his gut. In regard to what? He felt responsible for Toth's murder. He felt responsible? How come? A breach of confidentiality. As in what? I don't get it. Toth's whereabouts, she said. I gave him the address and phone number of the Gramercy. Tom thought someone used the information to track Toth down and kill him. It was driving him crazy to think the man might have died because of his carelessness. I felt myself blinking at the phone, trying to make sense of what she'd said. But Selma tells me Tom was always tight-lipped. That was one of her complaints. He never talked about anything, especially when it came to his work. It wasn't talk at all. He thought someone took an unauthorized look at his notes. But his notebook is missing. Well, it wasn't back then. Who did he suspect? Did he ever mention a name? Someone he worked with. And that's my guess, by the way, not something he said to me directly. Why else would it bother him if it wasn't someone betraying the department? I felt myself grow still. I flashed on the officers I'd met in Nota Lake. Rafer Lamotte, Tom's brother Macon, Hatch Brine, James Tennyson, Earlene's husband Wayne, even Deputy Carrie Badger, who'd taken my report on the night of the assault. The list seemed to go on, and all of them were connected with the Nota Lake Sheriff's Department or the CHP. At the back of my mind, I'd been flirting with a possibility I'd scarcely dared to admit. What I'd been harboring was the suspicion that my attacker had been trained at a police academy. I'd been resisting the notion, but I could feel it begin to take root in my imagination. He'd taken me down with an efficiency I'd been taught once upon a time myself. Whether he was currently employed in some branch of law enforcement, I couldn't be sure, but the very idea left me feeling cold. "Are you telling me one of Tom's colleagues was involved in a double homicide?" I think that was his suspicion, and it was tearing him apart. Again, this wasn't something he said. This is my best guess. This time I was silent for a moment. I should have seen that. How stupid of me. Shit! What will you do now? Beats the hell out of me. What would you suggest? Why not talk to someone in internal affairs? And say what? I'm certainly willing to give them anything I have, but at this point it's all speculation, isn't it? Well, yes. I guess that's one reason I didn't call myself. I've got nothing concrete. Maybe if you talk to Pinky's daughter up there, it will clarify the situation. Meanwhile, alerting the guy that I'm breathing down his neck, I said. But you can't do this on your own. Who am I going to call? The Nota Lake Sheriff's Department? I'm not sure I'd do that, she said, laughing for once. Yeah, well, if I figure it out, I'll let you know, I said. Any other comments or advice while we're on the subject? She thought about it briefly. Well, one thing, though you may have already thought about this, it must have been general knowledge that Tom was working on this case, so once he dropped dead, the guy must have thought he was home free. And now I come along. Bad break, I said. Of course, the guy can't be sure how much information Tom passed to his superiors. Exactly. If it's not in his reports, it might still be in circulation somewhere, especially with his notes gone. You'd better hope you get to him before someone else does. Maybe the guy already has them in his possession. Then why is he afraid of you? You're only dangerous if you have the notes, she said. I thought about the search of Tom's den. You're right. I'd proceed with care. Trust me, I said. One more question while I have you on the line. Were you ever in Nota Lake yourself? Are you kidding? Tom was too nervous to see me there. I replaced the receiver, distracted. My anxiety level was rising ominously, like a toilet on the verge of overflowing. The fear was like something damp and heavy sinking into my bones. I have a thing about authority figures, specifically police officers in uniform, probably dating from that first encounter while I was trapped in the wreckage of my parents' VW at the age of 5. I can still remember the horror and the relief of being rescued by those big guys with their guns and nightsticks. Still, the sense of jeopardy and pain also attached to that image. At 5, I wasn't capable of separating the two. In terms of confusion and loss, what I'd experienced was irrevocably bound up with the sight of men in uniform. As a child, I'd been taught the police were my pals, people to turn to if you were lost or afraid. At the same time, I knew police had the power to put you in jail, which made them fearful to contemplate if you were sometimes as bad as I was. In retrospect, I can see that I'd applied to the police academy in part to ally myself with the very folks I feared. Being on the side of the law was, no doubt, my attempt to cope with that old anxiety. Most of the officers I'd known since had been decent, caring people, which made it all the more alarming to think that one might have crossed the line. I couldn't think when anything had frightened me quite as much as the idea of going up against this guy. But what could I do? If I quit this one, then what? The next time I got scared, was I going to quit that job, too? I went up the spiral stairs and dutifully started shoving items into my duffel.
End of Disc 6. Disc 7.
Chapter 18. The ocean was white with fog, the horizon fading into milk 100 yards offshore. The sun behind the clouds created a harsh, nearly blinding light. Colors seemed flattened by the haze, which lent a chill to the air. A quick check of the weather channel before I departed showed heavy precipitation in the area of California, where I was headed, and within the first 25 miles I could already begin to sense the shift. I took Highway 126 through Santa Paula and Fillmore until I ran into Highway 5, where I dog-legged over to Highway 14. I drove through canyon country, balding brown hills tufted with chaparral, as wrinkled and hairy as elephants. Power lines marched across the folds of the earth, while the highway spun 6 lanes of concrete through the cuts and crevices. Residential developments had sprung up everywhere, the ridges dotted with tract houses, so that the natural rock formations looked strangely out of place. There was evidence of construction still in progress, earth movers, concrete mixers, temporary equipment yards enclosed in wire fencing in which heavy machinery was being housed for the duration. An occasional porta-potty occupied the wide aisle between lanes of the freeway. The land was the color of dried dirt and dried grass. Trees were few and didn't seem to assert much of a presence out here. By the time I'd passed Edwards Air Force Base, driving in a straight line north, the sky was gray. The clouds collected in ascending layers that blocked out the fading sun overhead. The drizzle that began to fall looked more like a fine vapor sheeting through the air. Misty-looking communities appeared in the distance, flat and small, laid out in a grid like an outpost on the moon. Closer to the road there would be an occasional outbuilding, left over from God knows what decade. The desert, while unforgiving, nevertheless tolerates man-made structures, which remain lopsided, with broken windows, roofs collapsing, long after the inhabitants have died or moved on. I could see the entire expanse of rain-swept plains to the rim of hushed, buff-colored mountains. The telephone poles, extending into the horizon ahead of me, could have served as a lesson in perspective. Behind the barren, pointed hills, rugged granite outcroppings grew darker as the rain increased. Gradually, the road moved into the foothills. The mountains beyond them were imposing. Nothing marred the featureless, pale surface. No trees, no grass, no mark of human passage. At higher elevations, I could see vegetation where low-hanging clouds provided sufficient moisture to support growth. I'd tucked my semi-automatic in the duffel. The gun experts, Dietz among them, were quick to scoff at the little Davis, but it was a handgun I knew, and it felt far more familiar to me than the Heckler & Koch, a more recent acquisition. Given the state of my bunged-up fingers, I doubted I'd be capable of pulling the trigger in any event. But the gun was a comfort in my current apprehensive state. Little by little, I was giving up my initial irritation with Selma. As with anything else, once a process is underway, there's no point in railing against the fates. I regretted that I hadn't had time to contact Leland Peck, the clerk at the Gramercy Hotel. I'd taken his co-worker's word that he had nothing to report. Any good investigator knows better. I should have taken the trouble to look him up so I could quiz him about his recollections of the plainclothes detective with the warrant for Toth's arrest. In the meantime, secure in my ignorance of events to come, I thought idly of the night ahead. I truly hate being a guest in someone's home. The bed seldom suits me, the blankets are usually skimpy, the pillows are flat or made out of hard rubber that smells of half-deflated basketballs. The toilet refuses to flush fully, or the handle gets stuck or the paper runs out, so that you're forced to search all the cabinets looking for the ever-so-cunningly hidden supply. Worst of all, you have to make nice at all hours. I don't want someone across the table from me while I'm eating my breakfast. I don't want to share the newspaper, and I don't want to talk to anyone at the end of the day. If I were interested in that shit, I'd be married again by now and put a permanent end to all the peace and quiet. By the time I arrived in Noda Lake at 6:45, night had settled on the landscape and the weather was truly nasty. The drizzle had intensified into a stinging sleet. My windshield wipers labored, collecting slush in an arc that nearly filled my windshield. My guess was the people of Noda Lake, like others in perpetually cold climates, had strategies for coping with the shifting character of snow. From my limited experience, the freezing rain seemed extremely hazardous, making the roadway as slick as a skating rink. In moments, I could feel the vehicle slide sideways, and I slowed to a snail's pace. At the road's edge, the dead grass had stiffened, collecting feathery drifts of whirling snow. Selma had bullied me into having supper with her. I'm easily influenced in food matters, having been conditioned these past years by Rosie's culinary imperiousness. When ordered about by any woman with a certain autocratic tone, I do as I'm told, largely helpless to resist. I parked out in front of Selma's, snagged my duffel, and hurried to the front porch, head bent, shoulders hunched, as though to avoid the combination of blowing rain and biting snow. I knocked politely, shifting impatiently from foot to foot until she opened the door. We exchanged the customary chit-chat as I stepped into the foyer and dried my feet on a rag rug. I shrugged off my leather jacket and eased out of my shoes, conscious of the pristine carpet. The house was toasty warm, hazy from the cigarette smoke sealed into the winter-proofed rooms. I shivered with belated relief at being out of the cold. I padded after Selma, who showed me to the guest room.
"Take whatever time you need to freshen up and get settled. I cleared some space in the closet and emptied a drawer for your things. I'll be out in the kitchen putting the finishing touches on supper. You know your way around, but don't hesitate to holler if you need anything."
"Thanks." Once the door closed behind me, I surveyed the room with dismay. The carpet here was hot pink, a cut-pile cotton shag. There was a four-poster bed with a canopy and a puffy, quilted spread of pink and white checked gingham. The same fabric continued in the dust ruffle and ruffled pillow shams stacked three deep. A collection of six quilted teddy bears were grouped together in a window seat. The wallpaper was pink and white stripes with a floral border across the top. There was an old-fashioned vanity table with a padded seat and a pink and white ruffled skirt. Everything was trimmed in oversized white rickrack. The guest bath was an extension of this jaunty decorative theme, complete with a crocheted cozy for the extra roll of toilet paper. The room smelled as though it had been closed up for some time, and the heat here seemed more intense than in the rest of the house. I could feel myself start to hyperventilate with the craving for fresh air. I crossed to the window like a hot prowl thief trying to escape. I managed to inch up the sash, only to be faced with a seriously constructed double-glazed storm window. I worked at the latches until I loosened all of them. I gave the storm window a push, and it fell promptly out of the frame and dropped into the bushes below. Oops! I stuck my head through the gap and let the blessed sleet blow across my face. The storm window had landed just beyond my grasp, so I left it where it was, resting in the junipers. I lowered the sash again and adjusted the ruffled curtains so the missing storm window wasn't evident. At least at bedtime, I could sleep in a properly refrigerated atmosphere. Selma had urged me to freshen up, and I used her advice to stall my return to the kitchen. I peed, washed my hands, and brushed my teeth, happy to occupy my time with these homely ablutions. I stood in the bathroom and stared at myself in the mirror, wondering if I'd ever develop an interest in the painful process of plucking my eyebrows. Not likely. My jaw was still bruised, and I paused to admire the ever-changing hue. Then I stood in the bedroom and did a quick visual scan. I removed my handgun from the duffel and hid it between the mattress and the box springs near the head of the bed. This would fool no one, but it would allow me to keep the gun close. I didn't think it would be wise to pack a rod in this town, especially without the proper permit. Finally, there was nothing for it but to take a deep breath and present myself at the supper table. Selma seemed subdued. Her attitude surprised me, given the fact that she'd gotten her way. I was back in Nota Lake, staying at her house, which was the last thing I wanted.
"I kept everything simple. I hope you don't mind," she said.
"This is fine," I said. She took a moment to stub out her cigarette, blowing the final stream of smoke to one side. This, for a smoker, constitutes etiquette. We pulled out our chairs and took seats at the kitchen table. Given my usual diet, a home-cooked meal of any kind is an extraordinary treat. Or so I thought, before I was faced with the one she'd prepared. This was the menu. Iced tea with sweet and low already mixed in. a green jello square with fruit cocktail, and an internal ribbon of Miracle Whip, iceberg lettuce with bottled dressing the color of a sunset. For the main course, instant mashed potatoes with margarine and a stout slice of meatloaf swimming in diluted cream of mushroom soup. As I ate, my fork exposed a couple of pockets of dried mashed potato flakes. The meatloaf was strongly reminiscent of something served at the Perdido County Jail, where there was an entire, much dreaded punishment referred to as being on meatloaf. On meatloaf means an inmate is placed on a diet of meatloaf and two slices of squishy white bread twice a day, with only drinking water from the faucet. The meatloaf, a 6-inch patty made of turkey, kidney beans, and other protein-rich filler, is served on something nominally known as gravy. Every third day, the law mandates that the inmate has to be served 3 square meals for one day, then back to meatloaf. By comparison to Selma's version, a simple QP with cheese came off looking like a gourmet feast, especially since I knew for a fact she didn't feed Brandt this way. Selma was quiet throughout the meal, and I didn't have much to contribute. I felt like one of those married couples you see out in restaurants, not looking at each other, not bothering to say a word. The minute we'd finished eating, she lit up another cigarette so I wouldn't miss a minute of the tars and noxious gases wafting across the table. "Would you like coffee or dessert? I have a nice coconut cream pie in the freezer. It won't take a minute to thaw. I can pop it in the microwave." "Golly, I'm full. This was great." "Are you cold? I saw you shiver. I can turn the heat up if you like." "No, no, really. I'm toasty warm. This was wonderful." She tapped her cigarette ash on the edge of her plate. "I didn't ask you about your fingers." I held up my right hand. "They're a little stiff yet, but better."
"Well, that's good. Now that you're back, what's the plan?"
"I was just thinking about that," I said. "I'm not sure what to make of this, and I don't want it going any further, but I think I have a line on what was bothering Tom."
"Really?"
"After we spoke this morning, I made another phone call. Without going into any detail..." I paused. "I'm not even sure how to tell you this. It seems awkward."
"For heaven's sake, just say it."
"It looks like Tom suspected a fellow officer in that double homicide he was investigating." Selma looked at me, blinking while she absorbed the information. She took a deep drag of her cigarette and blew out a sharp stream of smoke.
"I don't believe it."
"I know it sounds incredible, but stop and think about it for a minute. Tom was trying to establish the link between the two victims, right?"
"Yes."
"Well, apparently he believed one of his colleagues lifted Alfie Toth's address from his field notes. Toth was murdered shortly afterward. Toth was always on the move, but he'd just gotten out of jail and he was living temporarily in a fleabag hotel. This was the first time anyone had managed to pin him down to one location. No one else in Noda Lake knew where Alfie Toth was hanging out except him."
"What makes you so sure? He might have mentioned it to someone, or someone else might have come up with the information independently," she said.
"You're right about that. The point is, Tom must have gone crazy thinking he played a role in Alfie's death. Worse yet, suspecting someone in the department had a hand in it."
"But you don't really know," she said. "This is just a guess on your part."
"How are we ever going to know anything unless someone fesses up? And that seems unlikely. I mean, so far, this someone has gotten away with it."
"Who told you this?"
"Don't worry about it. It was someone with the sheriff's department. A confidential source."
"Confidential, my foot. You're making a serious allegation."
"You think I don't know that?" "Of course I am," I said. "Look, I don't like the idea any better than you do. That's why I came back, to pin it down."
"And if you can't?"
"Then, frankly, I'm out of ideas. There is one possibility. Pinky Ritter's daughter, Margaret." Selma frowned.
"That's right. I'd forgotten their relationship.
The connection seems odd, what with her working for Tom." "Noda Lake's a small town. The woman has to work somewhere, so why not the sheriff's department? Everybody else seems to work there," I pointed out.
"Why didn't she speak up when you were here before?"
"I didn't know about Ritter until yesterday."
"I think you better talk to Rafer."
"I think it's best to keep him out of this for now." I caught the odd look that crossed her face.
"What?"
She hesitated.
"I ran into him this afternoon and told him you'd be back this evening.
I felt my eyes roll in despair, and I longed to bang my head on the tabletop just one time for emphasis. I wish you'd kept quiet. It's hard enough as it is. Everybody here knows everybody else's business. She waved aside my objection like a pesky horsefly sailing through the smoke-filled air. Don't be silly.